From Philadelphia, it's Torah Talk. Hello everyone, I'm Michael Karasik, and this week we are reading Parshat Vayakhel, Exodus 35, 1 through 38, 20, the parasha in which the instructions that Moses was giving starting in Exodus 25 are fulfilled. Exodus 37, where we're going to start right now, starts, Bezalel made the ark. Bezalel was the talent. Moses just conveyed the instructions, but he really could not have done this on his own. But let's listen to what Bezalel makes, starting in Exodus 37, verse 6. He made a cover of pure gold. This is for the ark. 2.5 cubits long and 1.5 cubits wide. He made 2 cherubim of gold. He made them of hammered work at the 2 ends of the cover, 1 cherub at one end and the other cherub at the other end. He made the cherubim of 1 piece with the cover at its 2 ends. The cherubim had their wings spread out above, shielding the cover with their wings. They faced each other. The faces of the cherubim were turned toward the cover. Once again, their faces are turned toward each other, but also toward the cover of the ark. Well, I'm going to talk, I think for the first time on the podcast, about this amazing word cherub, so we will just be scratching the surface. But I have the entry from the Hebrew and Aramaic lexicon of the Old Testament on this week's handout for you, because, as you know, when you see that little dagger at the end of the entry, they are giving you there all the occurrences of the word cherub in the Bible. And I have a little, there's 91 of them in 66 different verses. 8 of the occurrences are in our parasha. This is ignoring the word kiruv. That's a place name in Ezra Nehemiah. And I have a little chart courtesy of the Accordance Bible software program to the left of the dictionary entry, where you can see that the places where this word cherub occurs heavily are here in the book of Exodus, 1 Kings, 2 Chronicles, and Ezekiel, all the places where a tabernacle slash temple and the specifications for it are described. But there are other places in the Bible where cherubs occur as well. One of them, famously, is in Genesis chapter 3, verse 24, where cherubim are set outside the Garden of Eden to prevent Adam and Eve from getting back in. And Rashi says there, cherubim are destructive angels. So let's talk a lot bit more about these cherubim, starting with Nachum Sarna's comment to the Genesis cherubim, not in his comment on the verse, but in an excursus to his Genesis commentary. He explains, two golden cherubim with outstretched wings overshadowed the cover of the ark in the tabernacle in the wilderness. And from the space between them issued the divine voice that spoke to Moses. Pictorial representations of the cherubim were also worked into the cloth curtains of that tabernacle. The same cherubic motif decorated Solomon's temple and was envisaged by Ezekiel in his restored temple. So those are all the big red bars in the little chart on page 1 of the handout, but now here are a few more of the other places. One of the epithets of God, especially in poetry, is the one enthroned on the cherubim. Biblical poetic texts also imagine the cherubim bearing the invisible throne of God from place to place. We'll come back to that. Archaeological findings in the Near East have shed some light on the mystery of the cherubim. The name would appear to be connected with the kuribu, the Akkadian term often applied to the composite figures, man-headed bulls with eagle's wings, that frequently stood outside Mesopotamian temples. The name seems to derive from Akkadian karabu, to pronounce formulas of blessing. Karabu and baraku maybe are metathesis, one of the other. The kuribu was an advocate for the faithful before the god and an advisor to the great gods, but it also guarded the entrance to the temple. And Jeff Teague says in his Exodus commentary in the Jewish Study Bible, cherubs are not the chubby, naked, winged boys known from medieval art, but winged composite creatures. Various types of such creatures are known from ancient Near Eastern art, such as winged sphinxes with lions' bodies, eagles' wings, and human faces, sometimes with a second animal face, and winged anthropoids with eagles' wings and birds' heads. I'm reminded of the joke about the mythological beast that has the head of a lion and the body of a lion, but not the same lion. Teague goes on, such creatures, frequently in pairs, serve as protective spirits for kings, their palaces, and thrones. Images of royal thrones with cherubs sculpted on their sides suggest that the ark cover represented God's throne and the ark his footstool. And now to William Propp's Anchor Bible commentary on the book of Exodus. Hebrew keruv has entered English as cherub. I have chosen instead griffin, lest one envision a humanoid angel, or worse, a pudgy toddler. And he points you to the places in rabbinic literature where you can find some discussion of the pudgy toddlers. English griffin comes from Greek grips, griffos, probably in turn derived from Semitic keruv. K and G, B and P is not such a strange linguistic leap. Very interesting. While the proper definition of a griffin in English is a winged lion with a falcon's head, the precise composition of the biblical kruv is unclear, and perhaps the term connotes any chimerical being. Griffins appear in three biblical contexts: as a decorative motif in sacred architecture, as guardians or denizens of paradise, and as the supports of the Lord's throne or chariot. Their most consistently mentioned feature is wings. Scholars most often imagine the griffins in the tabernacle and temple as constituting God's throne, but on what exactly does God sit? While Haran and Mettinger envision the griffin's inner wings meeting to form a seat, and I've had that picture, so probably some of you have had it as well, Propp says, I know of no pictorial evidence supporting such a view. And he finds some of the descriptions in the Bible hard to reconcile with it. In Ezekiel 1 and in all ancient depictions, for example, the Megiddo ivory, you can Google that one, and the Ahiram sarcophagus, the griffins do not support the god or king directly, but rather uphold his chair. And in a long section called Chair and Chariot, with just one paragraph that I'm going to give to you from this week's on this week's handout, but go to his extensive Exodus commentary for more. It says, we may now return to Exodus after many, many paragraphs discussing the griffins elsewhere. We may now return to Exodus, written for an audience familiar with Solomon's temple, aware of poetic references to Yud-Kei-Vav-Kei's griffins, and engaged with contemporary debate as to their significance. When one reads in Exodus of two golden griffins in the tabernacle's inner chamber, one initially brings to bear a preconceived image. YHWH's invisible throne, I should point out, prop uses the, writes out the, what is theoretically the name of the Lord, as many scholars think it is pronounced, and I don't say it or put it on the handout because Jews typically don't do that anymore. So I'm replacing, if you hear me say Lord or Yudke Vavke or YHWH or Hashem or whatever I dream up to say, he is actually saying God's name there. So when one reads in Exodus of two golden griffins in the tabernacle's inner chamber, one initially brings to bear a preconceived image, the invisible throne, and C.F. Ramban, Nachmanides. But this interpretation, the priestly writer who is writing these instructions for the tabernacle, and this is all from Prop's commentary on Exodus 25 and 26, I should point out that all of the commentators, ancient and modern, do most of their commenting on the two parshiot that describe putting together the tabernacle as instructions to Moses, and there's not as much by a long shot left to say once they Israelites actually start to put it together, which is where we are now. So we have this preconceived image of the Lord's invisible throne, but this interpretation, the priestly writer who is including these instructions according to Prop's view of the Torah, the priestly writer immediately undermines this interpretation. These griffins stand face to face, not side by side. You remember in Exodus 37:9, they faced each other. And so, Prop says, they conform even less than their cousins in the temple to Near Eastern throne iconography. When depicted face to face in art, griffins generally flank not a god, but a tree. Well, I'm not going anywhere that last comment, even though I have decided to feature it on the podcast this week, because the tree would not be Yudke Vavke, but it would be his Asherah that we find described in Kantilit Adrud, the stone pillar of ancient Israelite worship is God, but the tree is his female consort. And it's very hard for me to imagine the priestly writer or Moshe Rabbeinu or anyone writing in the Torah something that is calling to mind the female counterpart of the Israelite male god. But I could, of course, be wrong, because the cherubim would seem very clearly to violate the prescriptions in the Ten Commandments to not make anything, an image of anything that looks like it might be worshipped that isn't God, God's self. But I'll remind you that these cherubim are not merely on the ark cover, but if we go back to the previous chapter, Exodus 36:35, they made the curtain, that's the parochet separating the Holy of Holies that contains the ark, separating it, the parochet of blue, purple, and crimson yarns and fine twisted linen, working into it a design of cherubim. And if you go even further back, toward the beginning of Exodus 36, verse 8. All the skilled among those engaged in the work made the tabernacle, capital T, that's the Mishkan. They made it of 10 strips of cloth, which they made of fine twisted linen, blue, purple, and crimson yarns, into these they worked a design of cherubim. So it's kind of like these press conferences that you see in the sports pages with the alternating logos of the team and someone who has bought product placement, insurance company or soft drink or whatever it is. Their logo is behind whoever's giving the press conference, and the logo that is on all over the outside of the tabernacle is these cherubim. And if you make it inside the tabernacle, which I realize very few would do, then hanging on that big curtain keeping you away from the Ark of the Covenant, where these gold cherubim are, is an image of cherubim. Now, one more place where you might not have thought you would find a mention of cherubim is in the book of Numbers, but if you look at Numbers chapter 7, the chapter that describes the inauguration of this fabulous tent, the very last verse of it, verse 89, says, "When Moses went into the tent of meeting to speak with capital H him, he would hear the capital V voice addressing him from above the cover that was on top of the Ark of the Pact between the cherubim." That's how God spoke to Moses. And Baruch Levine says in his comment to that verse in his Numbers volume of the Anchor Bible, "The God of Israel is pictured as sitting astride the cherubs, Yoshev HaKruvim, in any number of biblical depictions. Hebrew Kiruv designates both what we would call a mythological being and an iconographic object. The term Kruv is usually regarded as a cognate of Akkadian Karabu, to beseech or pray. Akkadian also attests related forms, especially Karibu or Karibtu, terms designating a person or deity making a gesture of adoration or performing some religious act. The Hebrew form Kruv probably represents the active participial form, a worshiper or adorer. It indicates the function of the cherubs as worshipers of the deity. Are they there on the tent and on the parochet and maybe even on the cover of the ark to represent us, the worshipers? That's an idea that had never occurred to me before. I'll be back with you next week to finish up the description of the making the tabernacle in Parshat Pekudei, and with it to finish the book of Exodus. Until then, this is Michael Karasik saying thank you for listening.